Welcome, everybody. Part three of our series of Torah Motion, the Rabbinic Response, the Rise of Reform. A pleasure to see everybody. And we look forward to, of course, another, I'm sure, exciting, fun-filled, interesting, and informative lecture by Dr. Mark and Vakasha. Let's get started. Okay.
I hope so. And I know some of you joined us, and maybe the people with us in Morocco would have been a nice reunion with Rafi the other day. He's always fun to talk to. And at the end of class, Rabbi Kelman will announce the next person I'm speaking to this Wednesday. I have many, many emails and things. I don't think I can get to everything because I like to keep myself for 15 minutes. But let me just begin with what you can find on the internet is unbelievable. Here it goes. Meyer Lansky, there's his grave, Miami. But a number of people emailed me about, I mentioned the person I work with. He wrote a book on the mob. Well, here it is. Just came out recently. Joseph Krauss, The Kosher Capones, A History of Chicago's Jewish Gangsters. Now, the classic book is from a real historian, Jenna Weissman Joslin. I mean, the person I'm with is also a historian, but I mean, in terms of the Jewish, the classic work from an American Jewish historian is Our Gang, Jewish Crime in the New York Jewish Community. But there's another one. It's a very funny book. By someone that I've known almost my entire life, and that's Myron Sugarman, The Chronicles of the Last Jewish Gangster, From Meyer to Myron. If you want to be entertained, you can read it. You can watch his videos online. You can even watch him, believe it or not, in the rabbis of Boca Raton just 2 weeks ago interviewed him. And they had to say a few times in the video that we don't condone being a gangster, but it shows you that there's this this fascination that we Jews have with the people who didn't go the straight and narrow. We all know about the Talmid Chachamim and everything like that. But the gangsters, especially the gangsters who were proud Jews, who helped the new state of Israel, even before the state of Israel, and who fought with Nazis and all sorts of things. So that's anyone interested in the Jewish gangsters. That's what I will say for those who I told you I would get to that. I looked again in Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's book. I listened to the talk and I misspoke. The case where it said that a Catholic who said that he's not opposed to all war, just opposed to the Vietnam War, and that was upheld. That was actually it was the Federal District Court of San Francisco. You get all the information. It gives you the number and everything on page 267. It wasn't the Supreme Court, which explains why Irv Ruderman could lose his case. Someone asked me also at the end of the class, Rabbi Kelman said about the Shulchan Aruch and women and tefillin, that it says yesh limchos, you should protest, but it doesn't really say actually halachic violation. So let me show you that. Here you have it in Shulchan Aruch, Lamed Chet. If you look at Sif Gimel, it says Nashim Vavadi Baturi Mitfilin. It's a daytime thing. So men and women are putter. But look at the Ramah. Im Hanashim Rotsim Hachner Atzman. If the women want to do it, Mochim Biadan. We rebuke them. We tell them not to do it. I will add, however, and I don't know today, he's a little controversial. I'm not sure. Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, though, in his Panine Halacha, you can look at it, and he says that if a woman comes and she asks us that she wants to wear tefillin, she wants to raise herself in mitzvos, we tell her not. But if she continues to want to do it, tishto keik v'tirtzel anichan b'tzina, she wants to do it privately, he says there's yesh amilismoch, that she can rely on this. And if she wants to do it privately, put on tefillin, it is okay. Let's see what time. Oh, we've got a few more minutes. Okay, so I was listening, as I said, to the talk and the class last week. And someone asked me, we were speaking about the catacombs and in Rome. I mentioned the Jewish catacombs and the non-Jewish. And someone said, well, can a Kohen go down into the famous ones. You take tours. And I hesitated for like a second, and then I said no. And I'll tell you why I hesitated. I think I realized that I was listening to the class. And by the way, there's two things in particular, two times that this comes in is to play on our trips. One is when we go to Morocco. One of the places we go to is the tomb of the kings. It's a sight to behold. And then there's something else, something which I didn't know the first time I went there. There's a synagogue in Toledo, not Toledo, that's Ohio, Toledo. And there's two synagogues there. Both of them used to, obviously, they were confiscated when the Jews were expelled, or even could be before that, during after the pogroms of 1391. Now, really, they should give it back to us because they took it from us, and this is part of our heritage, and as well, there's a lot of tourist dollars there, although I don't think halachically they're obligated to, believe it or not, because there's been Yeyush, the Jews gave up hope, and it's transferred a few different times ownership, but they should give it back, but they're not giving it back. So one of them, it's called the Transito Synagogue, and after the first time I took a group there, I'm reading a book, and lo and behold, it talks about how knights were buried in there. You know, knights, K-N-I, knights. And I had never heard that before. I didn't know anything. I contacted the person who takes us around, a very special guide, and she investigated this, and she came back with the report that, no, there are no knights buried there. They had been removed in the 60s. So that was good. But she had been told by one of the people who runs all the tourist sites that nevertheless, even though the knights were taken out, other non-Jews had been buried there over the years. So then you have an issue. Can you go in? Can Kohanim go in? So this takes us to the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says as follows. In Yerideya Shin Ayin Beis, it says in Sif Beis, Kivrei Ovde Kochamim Nachon Lizaher. It's better that a Kohen not go, let's not walk on them, not be in a building with them, with non-Jewish graves. And the Ramah says, even though there are those who are meku or lenient, and he says the Rambam and others, he says it's best to be machmir. So we see that it's not a halachic obligation. It's best to be stringent. I found online just before I was looking. This is from Chabad, the Shulchan Aruch Harav. And the Shulchan Aruch Harav says it's forbidden for a Kohen to come into contact with the corpse of a Gentile. It's disputed among poskim if the tomb of an ohel applies to the corpse of a Gentile. So it's disputed as to whether he can enter the Gentile cemetery. Practically, although the main opinion falls leaning approach, it's proper not to step on their graves. So that seems to be the general minhag, I think, that Kohanim avoid this, even though it's a machokas. And there are major opinions to say it's not an issue. So we don't go there. And I'm glad I know about this now. What I was surprised to see is, as I was looking to see what contemporaries say about this today, I came across not a liberal authority, Rabbi Mansour. If you know Rabbi Mansour, he's on the right wing of the Syrians. He has the following question. May a Kohen attend the funeral of a non-Jew? And he goes through the sources I just mentioned. And he says, first of all, it's in a chapel or a church. You can't do it. But let's say it's not in a chapel or a church. Let's say it's just in a room. And he says as follows. He says that the Shulchan Aruch technically follows the lenient ruling. And therefore, he concludes, quote, there is no prohibition at all for non-Kohanim to attend the funeral of a non-Jew in a funeral parlor. Because he says that... if it's preferable not to do so, but if you feel it's necessary as a social or professional formality, it's a good friend of yours or something, and the family would expect it or it would look bad if it's in a funeral parlor, he says that you can go. Because mi'ikar hadin, the halacha is that a kohen, there's no issue of being metame to a non-Jew. What I find a little strange about this, though, is he makes such a big deal about if it's a chapel or a church, but in a funeral parlor, it could also be a religious ceremony. I mean, if it's just a general sort of ceremony, I get it. But let's say let's, I think most Christians in a funeral parlor, even though it's not a church, will still have a religious ceremony. So I wonder if that would be an issue. But you should know that if your kohanim want to come on our trips, we're very careful about all issues of tuma. I even have my walkie talkies, as some people here can attest. I'll give them the walkie talkie. So when I go in the cemetery, when I want to explain about different Gedolei Yisrael, they can stand outside. Or if you come with us this summer, God willing, to Central Europe, they redid the Chasam Sofer's kever. It cost them a fortune. There's a special place that the kohanim can stand, and everything is glatt kosher there when it comes to tuma and tara. Let's see. Got a couple more, two more minutes here. Yes, I mentioned last class, this is also is interesting, the minor tractates. We're speaking about tractate smachot, and I said it's a post-Talmudic tractate. But then I started wondering, well, is that really true? What do the modern scholars say? Maybe what I'm saying reflects older scholarship. So I pulled out the Encyclopedia Judaica, which itself is not the most modern. You're talking almost 50 years old, and it does say, some scholars assign these tractates to the end of the Gaonic period, but recent scholarship favors a much earlier date. And so I don't know if it's correct that they're post-Talmudic. They weren't accepted as having the status of a Talmud. And obviously a lot of the information in there is from the Talmudic period, and maybe, and some of it's later perhaps, but it's not necessarily clear whether that's the case. Okay, I have other things to say, but I'm going to hold off on this till next week, I think. I'll talk about this book next class, then, I guess. Some of you have it. It's a collector's item. The Manel Igrot, against Ramosha Feinstein. But I'll get to that next class. Okay. Let me put this away here. And one of the things I want to discuss is this idea of violating Shabbos for writing a Kameah. Or going to a tzaddik. Wait till you hear what I have. Oh, well, one more thing I could tell you right now. I also in the class, I forgot about Alexander. I said I wasn't, was it talking about when he was assassinated or attempted assassination? The reason I was confused is because in 1881, that's when he was killed. But before that, I thought there was only one or two attempts on him. It turns out there were five attempts on his life before they actually killed him. So, there you go. Okay, let's put this all away. I want to speak now. Let's return to what we are doing. Let me pull it in front, all my stuff here. We're talking about reform. We're going to move forward in that. At the end of last class, in the comments, someone asked about, what about all the things that reform, that Orthodox Jews do, that you can call that reforms as well? Ironically, just this week on Rabbi Slifkin's website, he even had a post on this. Five dangerous reforms in Orthodox Judaism. I think I would put these as reforms with a small r, because you have to distinguish between like halachic reforms and non-halachic reforms. Although I already told you about last year, you might recall that a reform that was all over the Hasidic world during COVID. The whole idea that you can have weddings of 1,000 people and have come to shul with hundreds of people, and before the vaccine, and not be concerned. People are dropping dead every day, and not be concerned about that with pikuach nefesh. I said that's, we are seeing an example of Reform Judaism before our eyes, despite the fact that these people have long bekeshes and payas and everything. But if you feel that pikuach nefesh has to be pushed aside, is pikuach nefesh is docha, because you need to go to the Rebbe's Tish. I mean, that's a form of Reform Judaism, no question about it. But Slifkin, so he gives, you can read his post, examples of what he thinks are reform. So, but it is a good point that we do have reforms of small R's and big R's, and that's going to be one of the issues. What's going to define a real reform, a halachically problematic reform, versus a reform with a small R? So, for instance, depending how much longer we go in this series, we'll see that Rav Shamshon Rav Hirsch had reforms also, and other Gedolim had reforms. But that's not what we're up. What we stopped was looking at this work. Rav Shaul Berlin, I'll give him the name Rav because he, at least he was a rabbi, but Shaul Berlin's Besamim Rosh, and I gave you the introduction. And so the book was published. Again, here's the title page. It wasn't long after the book was published. And of course, everyone bought it because you have all these responsa from Rishonim there. Once they start reading it, it became impossible to imagine that one of the important Rishonim, the Rosh, as well as other Rishonim, could have written what appears in there. And a huge campaign was then launched against Shaul Berlin, who already was in trouble for the work he published against the Torah Sukasio of Rafal of Hamburg. So all the rabbis started going up against Shaul Berlin that this could not be true. This had to be a forgery. I don't think they assumed that it was all forgery. They assumed he forged certain tshuvot. And the only one left standing for him was his father. The Chasam Sofer termed the book Kizvei HaRosh. That is not Kisvei, the writings of the Rosh, but the falsehoods of the Rosh. Rav Mordechai Benet of Nikolsburg. He's sort of forgotten today among most people because the Chasam Sofer who looked up to him, but the Chasam Sofer then overshadows him. If you come with me to Central Europe, we'll see his kever. He wrote a sefer called the Parashas Mordechai. He really was a giant. He also leads the attack against the Shaul Berlin. Today, all academic scholars recognize this work is a forgery. In fact, it's impossible to read the B'Samim Rosh in isolation from everything else we know about Shaul Berlin. How when he leaves the rabbinate, he comes to Berlin, he falls in with this Haskalah group, you have to understand it this way. But not all poskim recognize this. B'Samim Rosh continues to be quoted as an authoritative halachic work by poskim who either are completely unaware of the history. And when I say unaware, that means they don't read Achronim, so they don't know Mordechai Benet, and the Chasam Sofer, or they know, but they don't accept it. And as I showed you, a new edition of the B'Samim Rosh was published in 1984. Here's my copy of it, and I showed you last class the link that you can all buy this B'Samim Rosh if you choose to. It's at Mizrahi Books. And the editor of this, who is a fine Talmud Chacham, his name is Reuven Amar, he has a whole essay explaining why Shaul Berlin was one of the Gedol Yisrael. And all he does is look at the B'Samim Rosh. He knows nothing about Shaul Berlin's history and how he was in with the Hamaskilim. But he comes down firmly on the side of Shaul Berlin. He sees him as falsely persecuted. Now, in the back of the book, this new edition, you have his notes. Many, many pages, like 75 pages of notes, which are very helpful because he calls attention to a lot of strange ideas there and then tries to justify it, and he helps us understand some of the stuff that's going on there. The book has the Haskama of Rav Avadya Yosef. Now, Rav Avadya Yosef, he knows that the B'Samim Rosh is forged, and he writes about it in the Yibei Omer, but he says that just like with the book of Ben Sira, the Talmud says that you could take what's good in it. He says if there's a good svar in the B'Samim Rosh, you could take it, not because of Shaul Berlin, you're not relying on his authority, but if he makes a good suggestion and how to read a text, you can use it, but you're not relying on the books per se. And as I said, there's a big debate among the poskim, not among the academic scholars. Did he forge the entire volume with all the hundreds of tshuvot, or did he have an actual manuscript and he just put in his fake tshuvot? I think the former is the case. The stipler, in other words, I think that all the tshuvot, most of them are just run-of-the-mill, not problematic, are done to provide cover. Now, the stipler, very important figure, the stipler of Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, the father of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, he was approached by someone who wanted to write and I mentioned this in Changing the Immutable. He was approached by someone who wanted to write a history of the Haskalah movement. Write a history for the Haredim about how bad the Haskalah was and all the terrible things they did. And of course, if you're going to do that, you have to write about Shaul Berlin. What could be worse than a maskil, a rabbi who's like really a maskil, publishing a book with all sorts of phony heterim and tshuvot to try to undermine traditional Judaism from the inside by attributing to the great figures like the Rush halachic decisions? And people start relying on these halachic decisions. So that's pretty bad. But he didn't know how to deal with Shaul Berlin, because here you're dealing with someone who is one of the big rabbanim. It's not your normal thing to have a great rabbi who then goes to the dark side, if you want to use the Star Wars terminology. Well, the stipler told him as follows, and I think it's fascinating. He says, do not write anything. He says, write all about how bad the Haskalah was. Yes. but don't write anything about Rochelle Berlin. Now, why not write about Rochelle Berlin? He's a classic example, you could say, of an apikoris. He's the one who knows the truth and then just goes off and rejects it all. Listen to what the Cypher says. He says, first, because of the honor due his forefathers, his father, his uncles, going back generations, his great-grandparents, these are all Gedolei Yisrael. And it's a busha, it's an embarrassment to the family to know that such a person came out of that. So that's the first reason he says not to write about it. The second reason is, this sort of assumes that if you deal with someone like Shaul Berlin, that somehow the honor of his forefathers is reduced. I don't see it that way. I think we should be sophisticated enough to know that. Look at Aaron, the great Aaron. Some of his children didn't turn out so well, and we can give other examples also. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't succeeded by his children. We all heard about Esav. We heard about Yishmael, although maybe I should take Yishmael back, because Yishmael, traditionally, he's thought to be also a Baal Tshuva. And that's why you have in the Mishnah, Rabbi Yishmael. You even have one of the great, the last great important halachic sage in Italy, dies in the first part of the 9th century, Rav Yishmael HaKohen of Modena. Today you can never name a kid Yishmael because of the Arab-Israeli dispute. No one's going to name a kid Yishmael. But Yishmael is a kosher name. I'm a Rabbi Yishmael. You got it right there. You can't argue with explicit, Talmudic statements. I'm a Rabbi Yishmael. We say it all the time. The second reason the Cypher says not to write about him is that perhaps Shaul Berlin has already received his onesh in heaven. He's already received his punishment and he's now cleansed. So therefore, you're going to bring it up. That causes more problems. This, I have to say, b'mechilat kvodo to the Cypher, this I don't understand at all. Because you could say that then about any sinner, that you can't speak. We're not going to be able to speak about Geiger or Jacobson or any other people we're going to speak about. And the Cypher would say to me, that there's a difference. Those people were heretics from day one, so they're just bad. But here you have someone who was a Talmud Chacham and presumably a Tzaddik. He becomes a heretic, so we assume that he went back to his Girsa D'Yankasa, went back to his roots. But I have to say, I've never heard of such a thing like that. We all know about people who became heretics, and I've never heard it. You're not supposed to talk about them on the country. If you're going to Rambam and elsewhere on the country, you're supposed to speak about them because Dafka, because they're heretics, you're supposed to expose them. But that's what the Cypher says. Now, I think, although he doesn't say this, I think the subtext of the Cypher, everything he's saying, is that the Talmidei Chachamim know all about this. And they know who Shaul Berlin was, so they don't need to worry about, we don't need to worry about them using Besamim Rosh. The issue here is only for the masses. Do we need to let the masses? Joe Schmo and B'nai Brak, does he really need to know about this? That's the issue. And again, I would take issue with the Cypher because I don't think all the poskim know about this. There's plenty of poskim who don't know this story and it could illuminate it for them. Now, the last two reasons the Cypher gives, I think, are the most interesting and the most important as well. He writes that discussing, you're going to write a book on the Haskalah, discussing the episode of Shaul Berlin will be humiliating for those sages who were taken in by the forgery. And there have been sages who were taken in. I think the Cypher assumes that in the early, there's actually more today who were taken in. In Shaul Berlin's day, other than his father, I don't really know of anyone who was taken in. But as you get to more modern times, you have plenty who were taken in. So maybe that's what he was referring to. And he says, if you do this, it'll be embarrassing to those sages who were taken in by the forgery. It will reflect poorly on them. Again, I have to say that means that we can't discuss the Yerushalmi Kutchin. In a couple of weeks, we're going to speak to Rabar Hoberlander from Budapest. He's the world's expert on the Yerushalmi Kutchin. You know how many Gedolei Yisrael were taken in by the Yerushalmi Kutchin? Many more than were taken in by Shaul Berlin. The Yerushalmi Kutchin in the early times, it's published. I can show you, I have a copy of it. It was published by the Hagos of the Marsham, the great Marsham, the Posek Acharon, they called him. And also Shlomo Buber, the great academic scholar, and many good, the Chafetz Chaim was taken in. The Chafetz Chaim starts wearing tefillin Rabbeinu Tam because of the Yerushalmi Kodshim. But then he gives, and the final reason the Cypher gives is that, and this I find fascinating, the faith of the simple people, of certain people, which means the simple people, will be weakened if they see that a great Torah scholar could become a heretic. And he concludes by saying that an article, you can write all about the terrible results of the scholar, but don't mention anything about Shaul Berlin and the Torah scholars who were led astray. But I think the last reason is interesting because, look, for the simple people, not the people on Torah in Motion, but the simple people who are listening to other talks, they just assume that the more Torah you learn, the greater tzaddik you become, the greater Talmid Chacham, and that's everything's great. If you actually expose them to someone who grew up in a rabbinic family, who was a posek and a rav and a future gadol b'Yisrael, and lo and behold, he goes off to the dark side, that they won't be able to handle it. Now, anyone who's sophisticated has heard of Acher, you know, Elisha ben Avuya. You've heard of other people in those circumstances. You heard of Louis Ginsberg, for instance. But I mean, Louis Ginsberg, who knew more than Louis Ginsberg? The Zweibrucker is saying that, you know, for the average person, at least in his community, this is something that we don't want them to be exposed to this information. Incidentally, I almost said Rav Tzair, Chaim Chernovitz, a figure we spoke of a number of times. But one of the things I discovered on my trip to Israel a few weeks ago, I discovered lots of good stuff, including color pictures of Rav Yaakov Weinberg. No one's ever seen him. They've never been out there. I'm going to put them on the blog post, not the next one, the one after. And then you'll see these will then become the famous pictures. No one's going to remember that I discovered it. I might put them on there, but that's okay. But the reason I'm not showing you them now is because I learned my lesson. Someone's going to pull it off the video and do what they did with Heschel, remember, and create the talus with the different colors and put it out there. So everyone, and they took the Lieberman pictures I showed you, and they were going all over the internet. And so someone sent them to me and said, have you seen these pictures? I said, have I seen these pictures? I'm the one who put the pictures out there, and thanks to one of our listeners. And then I told the whole story on a blog post. But I discovered the ethical will of Chaim Chernovitz, believe it or not, Rav Tzair, when he was still in Berlin. But even then, he had left Odessa, and everyone assumed already he was no longer among the pious ones. And it's such a religious document to his family. He's going in for an operation, and he says to them, I might not come out of this operation, so I want you to remember, you know, always to be proud of your Judaism and be aware that the most important thing is not material pursuits, but spiritual pursuits, and keep Eretz Yisrael close to you. He was a big Tzioni. So what an ethical will. If there's a whole genre of ethical wills. I'm not going to reveal where I discovered this, because I don't want, again, all these people are going to go with take it out from under me, but it's a great, great document. People are going to love this document when I publish this, because it shows you the piety of Rav Tzair. Now, some cynic is going to say, well, what do you expect? He's going under the knife. He's having an operation, so now he's focused on these things. Okay, it could be, but you know, Shlomo Pinnis, in Zev Harvey's memoir of Shlomo's eulogy article on Shlomo Pinnis, the translator of Mor Nevuchim, and he was a complete atheist, but a great scholar. He tells how even in the hospital at these last days, when the nurse was there in the Jerusalem hospital, and Pinnis made some comment, I guess, and she said, even now, like even when you're on death's door, you know, this is your attitude. And yep, that's, you know, he was able to go, you know, meet his maker without having any other feelings. So we're getting back to the Besamim Rosh. There are these, Moshe Kapo and another person, they put these books on the computer, and they do all these tests, and they can show if it was one author, multi-authors, when it was written. They haven't yet done Besamim Rosh, but when they do Besamim Rosh, they will find all sorts of problems. In my article on suicide in the world to come, I point out that this concept that if you commit suicide, you have no share in the world to come is not found in any of the Rishonim. It's a much later idea. Well, not found in any of the Halachic Rishonim. It's an Islamic idea. So you have like a philosophical text that has it, but the Besamim Rosh knows this. So I see that as a proof, an internal proof. Also, you see in the Besamim Rosh, Harav Hanal is used, the expression, Hein Nun Lamed, Hanizkar Lamala, or other versions of that, Lael, and Israel. That is not found, I believe, until the Maharil. This is not my proof. Someone else said this. So there's all sorts of examples, but we don't need to these technical things. I want to show you a couple tshuvot now. When you ask yourself, is it possible that the Rush or any Rishon for that matter could have said these things? And this is what the Rav Mordechai ben Net and the Chasam Sofer and so many others went crazy about. Now, what I'm going to try to show in my article is that I found all sorts of little tidbits scattered. The forgers always like to leave little things, and I think I've identified some tidbits as well. But before looking at some of the tshuvot, which I believe, not just I believe, but a reformist tshuvot, I think it's not only, and this is important, it's not only the conclusions of the tshuvot that are problematic, but also the argumentation. Here's an example I gave in Changing the Immutable. I hadn't seen other people mention this example, but I think it's quite significant. In the Besamim Rosh, he has in one of the unsigned tshuvots, some are signed by the Rosh, others are just unsigned. It states that Rabbeinu Tam, the great Rabbeinu Tam, declared that the scholars of his day, we're talking in France now, medieval France, should assemble in order to void the prohibition on non-Jewish wine. Why? Since Rabbeinu Tam, in quotes, Rabbeinu Tam, says that the wine that the non-Jews use is no longer connected to idolatrous ceremonies. That's a bit of a problematic statement, because what about the Eucharist? But okay, so I guess you're supposed to assume that Rabbeinu Tam doesn't see it as idolatrous. So here you have the Rush, it's unsigned, the Besamim Rosh telling you that Rabbeinu Tam said that all the Rabbanim should come together and void the prohibition on non-Jewish wine because it's no longer used for idolatrous ceremonies. The response continues that Rabbeinu Tam was convinced to shelve this idea, to reject this idea. Why? Because Rabbi Shimon, whoever this Rabbi Shimon is, pointed out to him that in the future, the wine could once again be used for idolatrous ceremonies. So on the surface, there's nothing radical with this response, because Rabbeinu Tam has this crazy idea, but he's convinced it's a mistake. So in the end, Rabbeinu Tam says, you're right, I retract it. And the response and the conclusion of the tshuva is, non-Jewish wine, usser. So you could say, well, that's a conservative tshuva. That's a traditional tshuva. But really, because the basic idea that the prohibition could be voided has been raised. And it's raised in the mouth of none other than Rabbeinu Tam. And what does this mean? This is medieval times. Hundreds of years after Rabbeinu Tam, 700, 800 years, whatever it is, after Rabbeinu Tam, when it's obvious that Rav Shimon's concern that maybe once again they'll start to use wine in idolatrous ceremonies has not materialized, the logical result would be to return to Rabbeinu Tam's original idea that today there's no reason to have a prohibition on non-Jewish wine. In other words, through this tshuva, and I don't think anyone has made this point. Well, I did in Changing the Immutable. I don't think anyone else did. At least I didn't see it. Through this tshuva, which ostensibly is a machmir tshuva, Besamim Rosh has subtly undercut the prohibition against non-Jewish wine, which was exactly Shaul Berlin's point. At the end of it, the whole reason for the prohibition is that maybe one day they'll start using it for idolatrous ceremonies. Well, it's been 800 years, let's say, since Rabbeinu Tam. They haven't started using it yet. There's no difference, and there's no signs they're going to. So let's go back to Rabbeinu Tam's original point that there's no need for it. So and you have other examples of this, and this is what I'm going to try to show in my article. A lot of people have spoken about the couple tshuvot we're going to look at now, which come up with radically liberal, you know, conclusions that are unimaginable for a Rishon. What I want to show is that in tshuvot that are ostensibly stringent, the fact is he throws out opinions of Rishonim, which we have no record of, that advocate these liberal ideas, and then it's shot down. Bessamim Rosh says, no, but this can't be, and rejects it. So you say, well, Bessamim Rosh is machmir, but no, because he's already throwing out. It's like if I were to quote some crazy idea and attribute it to Ramosha Feinstein or Sipiasa Frank or something like that, you know, I put it out there already. Even though if we're not nohed to follow this, I've already lessened the level of the prohibition. Because after all, Ramosha says that it's not really usher. Of course, I've invented it. But to be a good forger and to make social changes, you don't need to you don't need to do it all yourself. All you need to do is set the stage and put it out there that one of the Gedolei Yisrael has said it's not a problem. Okay, so then in this generation, we assume it's usher. But next generation, someone's going to say, well, I hold like Rabbeinu Tam, and let me give you more reasons. But there is no Rabbeinu Tam. This is all invented by Shaul Berlin. So, but let me show you three tshuvot quickly. I'm going to read you the summaries. You have a very good summary of them in this book, Theology in the Responsa by Louis Jacobs. This is a very helpful volume. There's no real insights, analytical insights. What it does is it goes from the Gaonic period into the 20th century, and it takes the major poskim, all the who wrote the tshuvot, volume, responsa, and he just picks out all the tshuvot that deal with theological or philosophical matters. And it shows you, for instance, that the great poskim were also, this is one of Jacob's point, that all the great halachists were also great agadists. That's a word he invented, I think. But if you can say halachist, I guess you can say agadist also. You have from all them, from the Rambam, from the Rish, Rif, the Rivash, all them discussions of philosophical, theological issues. But in the back, he has two appendices. One deals with the book, the Pachad Yitzchak. The Pachad Yitzchak was written by Rav Yitzchak Lompronti. Oh, what a fascinating person he was. He was the Rav of Ferrara, and he also had a yeshiva there, and he was a doctor, a real doctor, Talmud Chacham, like Eddie Reichman or a few others, David Shabtai. We don't have that. We have a lot of rabbi PhDs because they're sort of like their cognate, you know, the same sort of issues. But to be a Talmud Chacham and a medical doctor, those are really two separate genres. We originally, on our first trip to Italy, we were supposed to go to Ferrara because I had been there. I'd done all the planning and I could see the show. And then there was an earthquake a few months before and we couldn't go. So, but we weren't sure until we actually were on the trip if we could go, because it wasn't clear whether they were going to open the museum or not. By the way, the museum ended up being closed for years. It only recently reopened. Subsequently, we cut the tour one day shorter. But we wouldn't go. But so then we didn't know what to do. So we thought maybe, you know, speaking to Zoltan, our man Zoltan in those days was leading that trip. We thought maybe go to San Marino. You know, some of you like to knock off little countries, knock off all the countries. So you're not going to, if we're not taking you to San Marino, the odds of you going to San Marino are unlikely. You got the Vatican, which we do knock off. You got Andorra. You got a few of the little ones there. But then I came up with an idea. I said, why don't we go to Verona? And this is going to be very relevant because we're going to see the Rav of Verona. He's a central player in the story I'm going to tell. So like 2 days to go, we arrange all this. So we go to Verona. And also, I mean, there's a lot of Shakespeare angles to Verona as well. So that was interesting. It's a lover's like gathering place. They have all these things where you take these locks, you and your girlfriend, and you put them together and you put them, tie them onto this bridge. And then you go see where Juliet stood, so we went to Verona. We didn't go to Ferrara, but there's a street named Lompronti or Lompronti Square, right by where the shul is. And then he deals with all the theological stuff. And David Malkiel in Israel, a scholar in Israel, just came out with a book on the Pachad Yitzchak. So Pachad Yitzchak is famous for a few things. Most of it's more of an encyclopedia, but he has a number of entries where he has the big Italian rabbis, he records their tshuvot. And the most famous example of the Pachad Yitzchak is he records the dispute between the Pachad Yitzchak, Lompronti, and his teacher of Yehuda Briel about the question of lice. It was during the era of the Pachad Yitzchak, the 1700s, that they first figured out, the doctors, the scientists, that lice, we dealt with this a few semesters ago, lice do not grow from the sweat. That is, there's no abiogenesis, spontaneous generation. Just that you couldn't see it. You need magnifying glasses. So the question is, the Gemara says you can kill them on Shabbos. You kill things on Shabbos, kill lice on Shabbos. But now we know that lice reproduce like other insects. Do you have to be machmir for this new knowledge? And it's a machokis. I forget which side the Pachat Yitzchak. I think the Pachat Yitzchak is machmir. But this is a debate that continues to this day. I'm told that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was machmir and Rav Kafach is machmir. Others say that no, we go by what the sages say. We don't change it. So the Pachat Yitzchak, many, many volumes, very important. And then he has another appendix on the Besamim Rosh. And highly recommend it. So the first tshuva, which I just want to show you, and as we're looking at it, you wonder whether any Rishon could have said this, is number 240. Oops. And hold on a second, I got my paper here where I marked off the things I want to show you. Oh, it's a very small tshuva. And the issue is just as follows. The Sofer of the writes in Megillah, but on Yom Kippur, in Purim, when he gets drunk, you know, when the wine comes in, the truth comes out, that the Chazal say, and words of minus, some heresy, he starts going around speaking heresy because he's drunk. What type of heresy? Me sifre philosophia ha'umos. He's quoting philosophers. So now the question is the Megillah kosher? Because he wrote to Megillah, let's say, a little while ago, and now we see that he's really a heretic. So what do we do? But look at the question. Is the Megillah kosher? Kevan she'ein ba'shem. We don't have emet shav ela sipur maseh be'alma. It's just a story. That's all it is. It's not a holy book. It might be shame, actually. Kevin Shame Ba Shame. I think that's what it means. Yeah, there's no God's name. Yeah. Kevin Shame Ba Shame. Good question. Kevin Shame Ba Shame. Yeah. There's no name, God's name there. It's just a story. So what? Can you imagine a Rishon saying that Megillas Esther is just a story? It's already we see a downplaying of its significance. Now, what he says is as follows. he says, already it's fifth line there. He says, just because someone opens his mouth, bepikpukim, bimekomos achadim, he says some problematic things. We don't consider him a heretic. And he says, v'hinei b'ineinu. He says, we've seen great rabbis sometimes say these heretical or quasi-heretical things, not because they really were heretics, but they just wanted, you know, they said stuff like this. Already, again, can you imagine a Rishon saying this? And then he says, and it's sometimes in their books they write this, God should forgive them. And he says, you're not called an apikoros. Lo yikare apikoros, ela bevoit bedavar min advarim. If you actually, you know, consciously reject something, and even like something rabbinic, you say, I don't, you know, you say, be'omer datzav p'malei, or you deny a story in the Torah, or a miracle, or a mitzvah, then you're a heretic. However, if we're dealing with someone, it says that, he seems to be a pious Jew. He doesn't commit sins, but occasionally, Lifrakim, he'll say heretical things or quasi-heretical things that come from, you know, he learns philosophy. So because he learns philosophy, he comes and he starts spouting some ideas. Occasionally, he'll say it during Kiddush or during Torah reading between Aliyahs. He'll whisper something to you like, hey, you really believe this? So, you know, and he says something like that, and listen to this. I hate to say it because we're a family program here, but I don't see any children. He says, the eno maksha atzmo b'tadiras neged inyan min enyan gedola oktana. He says he doesn't, you know, he doesn't continuously, or, you know, he's more haphazard as opposed to being strong and, you know, on a continuous, firm in his denial of Torah matters. Now, I can't help thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is like an underhanded sort of inside joke. There's a phrase, I will not elaborate on it, Moksha Atzmo Adas. And that's what he says here. The Eino Moksha Atzmo. I've never seen this, and I've looked at anyone else use this expression in the way he's using it. That's already nivel peh, in my opinion, unless you could show me that other Rishonim. And I looked, and it doesn't mean I have, just because I looked, doesn't mean I found everything, but I searched to find if any other Rishonim use language like that. And unless you can show me there are other Rishonim who use language like that, I am holding by my opinion that we're seeing nivel peh right here in the nibul peh, actually, is a negation, the base, but in yeshivish we call it nivel peh. And then he goes on. He says, unless you're firm as a heretic, as opposed to just occasionally when the spirit comes on you, whisper your heretical ideas, you're not called an apikora scum or a min. And even if you are an actual heretic, that is, you state explicitly and you're firm on this, we don't go backwards. We don't say that... you know, it begins from this point on. We don't say, and by for this latter point, there's strong halachic sources that, you know, a Sefer Torah Shekasa of Min. We don't say that if he's a Min now, that the Torah he wrote 2 years ago. We assume that, unless we have evidence of it, we assume that he's only a heretic now. So, just to let me read, like this is or summarize of what Jacob says. Here you see he's downgrading the Book of Esther, he's regarding it as a mere tale. He's condoning the study of philosophy. Not only are doubts in matters of faith tolerated, but they're attributed to the great ones of Israel. And I'll go even further that, you know, the idea of he basically is mater here being a cynical apikoros. You know, the guy who, we're not talking about someone who, we're talking about the guy who comes to shul and likes to spread his heresies as opposed to someone who is a strong type of a heretic. And this is signed, as you could see, Asher Beharever Bichil. It's signed by the Rush. The Rush was so opposed to philosophy. He's the last person who would support philosophy. We'll see another tshuva as well. Even the Rashba could have found for some people philosophy, but the Rush was Talmud only. He's like the classic example of a Talmudist and only a Talmudist. We have very few of these in medieval times. Almost all the medieval Talmudists also either did Parshanut, they wrote on Chumash or Nach, or they did philosophy, they did mysticism. Almost all of them did. The Rush is like the one example I can think of. There are some others, but he's like the famous, the classic example where all he did was, he's like a modern day Rosh Yeshiva. Just Shas and Poskim. We have no evidence of him doing anything else. And this is the tshuva that the Rush wrote? No way. And this is an invention of Shaul Berlin, and the Gedolei Yisrael realize this. And so this is one of them. Now, this doesn't deal with reform per se. This is more of the Berlin's heretical side, undermining Judaism, maybe opening it up for reform. We will see soon a tshuva in which the entire reform program is set out. Okay, we have some time. Let me show you another tshuva. I don't have it here. I didn't make the copy of it, but it's 251. And that's a long one. And in this tshuva, he deals with principles of faith. Ikarei emuna, something that I've had an interest in for a long time. And in fact, I have to tell you, here you go. In the new Chakira, I just got it. I love Chakira. This is winter 2022. All sorts of good stuff in here. On page 107, from page 107 to 151, you have an entire article here, lengthy article called devoted to Mark Shapiro's analysis of Maimonides' 13 principles reappraised from Betzalel Sachachevsky. Musmach of Beis Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood, and also someone who's now studying at Toro College. I have to say, although he disagrees with me, you can only be honored that someone, a Talmud Chacham, and someone takes the time, it must have taken him months, to subject my work of over 20 years, of 20 years ago almost, to such detailed analysis. Even if in the end, it's not, he's not calling attention to errors. It's different ways of reading. It's just a different approach. I have more of the esoteric approach, and it could be I'll even agree and acknowledge some of his points. But I feel very honored that this, and it's a mechubadik article, the way scholarship should be done. Unlike another article that was written also last year, which is very different. Also, and right after that, you have another lengthy article against Joshua Berman, his recent book. So, but I know a bit about principles of faith, and so this tshuva of the Besamim Rosh has always interested me, number 251. So what does he say in 251 here? Hey, this is a this is also signed by the Rush, although he signs it like an abbreviation of his name, and it deals with principles of faith. So let me just summarize for you what. Let me just read Jacob's summary for you, or summarize Jacob's summary for you, because what appears here is just unbelievable. His major point is, one of his major points is that principles of faith change. That what was a principle of faith in one generation is not in a new generation. They need to be updated with the times. And what used to be a principle is no longer. And what's a principle now used to not be. Now, Solomon Schechter has an article, a famous article called The Dogmas in Judaism. And Solomon Schechter knows that this is written not by the Rush, but by Saul Berlin. He even says in the article, Saul Berlin. But Solomon Schechter likes Saul Berlin's position. In fact, he says that this is the best approach to dogma, the one of Saul Berlin, that it changes. But of course, that means it's not dogma. Dogma that changes is not dogma. By definition, dogma is eternal truth. But so here is... Oh, you're right, Hyman. You're absolutely right. It's Nivel with a vet, Vav. You're right. I just saw you say it there. You're right. I was thinking of Naval, like a Naval vicious a Torah. Absolutely. Okay, let me read you what sometimes we all slip. Thank you. Let me read you what Jacob's House summarizes it, because I can read it all with you, but it's just easier. He says as follows. He says, so which... He says, first of all, the Rambam says that he came up with his own reasoning, these principles, so they don't bind us. Then he says, which principles are we formulated depends on the spiritual climate. And then he says that, like, there used to not be a principle in the coming of the Messiah, now there is. The only true principle is that God has made a covenant with his people. He desires our well-being and happiness. That's the major principle, and he wants us to reflect on why we have to endure such a long exile. But this is... Then he says as follows. I have to read you this in Hebrew. Unbelievable what he attributes to Rush. There's nothing like this in any traditional Rishonic literature. He says, if you can ever imagine, im chas v'shalom hayefshar litzayer, if you could ever imagine, ki yagia zman, that a time would come, shemishpatei ha-Torah u-mitzvateha, that the laws of the Torah, yaviu ra'a u-maseinu, will cause problems for us. The Jewish people as a whole, or even if there's, you can imagine, or you can imagine that the mitzvos would not give us happiness, not just that they would cause us problems, but they wouldn't give us happiness. We would throw off the mitzvot. Why? Because the basis from what all Torah depends upon, that because God commanded us to do that because he wants it to be good for us, Dvar Tov al Yisrael, and to make us, you know, above the non-Jews, to be an Am Chacham v'Navon. But if it ever happened, he says, that we do not feel. Now he says, but it can never happen because, of course, the mitzvahs will always be permanent and will always be make us happy and give us and will never create problems for us. But if you could imagine that this ever would, in theory, then God will not want us to observe the mitzvos. So that's the Rush writing it in medieval times, but now you're in the 18th century. The end of the 18th century, well, certainly the mitzvos don't give a lot of people happiness. They cause a lot of problems, and they prevent you from integrating in non-Jewish society and going to the university because you can't go on Saturday, all these sorts of things. So what he's done is he's given the Rush, he's had the Rush say that in theory, if it ever happens that the commandments are problematic and you don't get happiness, then you can reject them. And God wants you to reject them. But of course, this would never happen because the Torah is eternal. But if it ever would happen, God doesn't want you to be upset. If it's observing Shabbos causes you pain and it bothers you, God doesn't want you to be bothered because God loves you and he wants you to be happy. And the Torah is supposed to make you happy. And if it doesn't make you happy, you can get it off. And then, and Jacob says, the Rush continues at length to convey the program of early reform as it was adopted in the late 18th century Berlin. Barely concealed here are all the trends that became so prominent in the early reform movement. One, the Messianic age is not necessarily one in which the temple will be rebuilt. Theoretically, there may come a time when observance of the mitzvot may become detrimental to Israel's well-being and then have to be given up. The reason why the Jewish people fails to find the answers to his problems is because it's overlaid the essential Torah with the practices it has made up. He later on, the Rush, in quotes, talks about all the superstitions that people have done. And then Jacob says, all that is needed to give the game away is for the Rush to use the word enlightened. But the enlightened who read the responsum can have no doubts as to its intention. I just think it's hilarious that Jacob said this because I think Jacob was looking at concentrating on the last section. This way, because if he looked at the earlier section, he would say, and I marked it, I guess he saw it, but he doesn't indicate it. He uses the word maskil twice. Now, the word maskil also appears in earlier times. Maskil, Yisro, Kazor, Arkia. But he does use the word maskil. So if you read the word maskil, not as a medieval usage of it, you can actually read it as maskil, and everything reads, perfect as proto-reform. You have, as Jacob Schoen correctly says it, you have all the elements of what's going to become Reform Judaism in this very responsum. Now we have one more responsum to do, but we will do that next time. And then we'll move into, real reform, actually, not proto reform, not underhanded secret reform. I think basically what you can't be an open reformer. I'm not sure whether Shaul Berlin is a reformer or just someone who wants to tear it down. When you see a tshuva like this, it seems like he's not trying to tear it down. He's trying to create like a deist type of or a reformist type of Judaism where all you have to do is be happy and you don't really need to observe the mitzvot. But in the other tshuvot, it seems like it's more underhand. He's more interested in undermining traditional practice. Reform is not interested in undermining traditional practice just for the sake of undermining. That's like a nihilistic perspective. So I'm not sure where, and wait till next guest, I'll show you where Shaul Berlin ends up. So let me answer the questions. Noah says anything with a gezayit of bread is a suda. Well, you might say anything with a gezayit of bread is a suda, but my question is, can you have a suda without a gezayit of bread? That is, a kazayit of bread makes it a suda, but does a suda need to have a kazayit of bread? That's my question, and there's no Indian of Lecha Mishnah by Purim. So that was my question. I'll tell you who it was. It was Rabbi Abadi who I asked. And he said that he doesn't know. So I guess that's also good. You want poskim who sometimes say they don't know. You know, most of the time you ask, they always have the answer to everything. So at least to be honest and say, I don't know, that's... That, I think, says something. So you can answer local posek, do you need to have bread? And if he says, yes, you need to have bread on Purim, ask him why. What's the basis? What's the source that you need to have bread? And do you need to have basar? I would think Hadassah says, it's also the Jews of Sing Song by Ron Ahrens. I mean, Sing Sing should be, I guess. and Tough Jews by Rich Cohen and The Prison Minion. Yeah, there's the Jews I'm speaking about, though, don't worry about so much about Minion, but I mean, the gangsters. But you're right. There's a lot of books, but these are just the ones that, and Jenna Jocelyn, she's like a real historian, not just interested in good stories. But Sugarman's book, he's spoken at all the Chabads around the country, and he's a character. His son it's not secret. If you live in Boca, you know his son's one of the big rabbis down there. And look, I grew up with him, and he's a character. Go to one of his videos online to see what I mean. Danny says that Bratislava's Chasam Sofer Graves has supposed Cohen allowable space in spite of the roof overhead. Yes, that was before I said it. Yes, they built it with a fortune, and you go there and the Cohen can come in and stand up there, and it's an architectural wonder, the grave of Ramosha Sofer, and the story of how those graves were saved when everything else was destroyed. We'll tell it this summer, God willing. Where exactly in Panim B'Halakha is the permission for women to wear tefillin in private? I printed out the page because I don't have the sfarim, but it's Hilchas Tefillin. It's easy to find. I'm looking at it here. It's Halakha.
But Kelman put it out.
What?
I put down the story.
Oh, you put it out. Okay, put it out. By the way, I last class, I misspoke. I said he sold thousands of copies. I meant to say he sold a million. They say a million. There's no safer in history that's ever sold that much. It was like 10 years ago, they had a big party because he sold 500,000. They use it, I'm told, in all the Israeli schools. There's never been anything like this in terms of sales for a living author. I mean, Shmir Shabbos Kol Chassa sold a lot, and Rav Zevin, but this is unheard of. And they're trying to destroy him now. They really are trying to destroy him, but he's not going to be so easy to destroy, because I have to say he's not one of the liberal type of rabbis, number one, generally, although he has some liberal positions, but he's a real Talmud Chacham of the first order. So the problem with a lot of these liberal, progressive type of Orthodox rabbis is they say things you might want to hear, but it's not like they're not Gedol Yisrael. He's in the religious Zionist world. I mean, he's one of the Gedol Yisrael. So, Rabbi Yellen says the quote I cited applies to non-Kohen. I'm not sure what you're referring to.
You read from Rabbi Mansour's article, but you actually read the part about it says non-Kohanim.
Oh, I read non-Kohanim? Let me see. I thought I just saw it
immediately
quickly
before the last paragraph.
No, it says a co. No, Yaakov, here. Here, I'm going to show you. I did read it quickly, but I found it right before. But here it is. A Kohen, look at the bottom. A Kohen may attend the funeral of a non-Jew if it is not held in a church or chapel, though it is preferable to avoid doing so unless his attendance is necessary as a social or professional formality.
But so you read the sentence.
Oh, I read it. You see, I read it by mistake. Well, thank you. Yeah. I have to say, I feel much sympathy for politicians, because every time I listen to the classes, I misspeak. You know, I'm speaking quickly. I'm saying a lot of things. They're not written down. It's coming off the top of my head. It's so easy to misspeak. And I know with politicians, when they say they misspeak, everyone rolls their eyes. But I can tell you and most of the time, it's probably deserving to roll your eyes. But I can tell you that misspeaking is now, I'm not talking about misspeaking when someone says, were you there? And they say no. And then you have the video, they were there, and they say they misspeak. I'm talking about the other stuff. Mistakes can easily be made. Okay, let me get back now to the questions. Thomas says that Justice Chaim Cohen, I think in his memoir, says that when his Austrian combined a high school visited the cathedrals to see the artwork, he had to wait outside because of the, the kvarim. You know, I remember him describing going to the cathedrals. And now I do remember, I cite this in my article on Eliezer Berkovitz's Tshuva on visiting churches. But I didn't remember about him standing outside. But that is and he was brought by his teacher, who was a well-known figure in German Orthodoxy. But that is the minhag. I don't know of anyone who says that as a general rule, you should do it. So that's why we avoid it. So we don't have, but I was a little surprised to see the Rabbi Mansour, no liberal, saying that if you feel that it's important for professional or social reasons that you can go to be matame for a non-Jew. That's I don't know. I don't think the other poskim accept this, but that's what he says. Judah says, Moshe and Aaron's lack of busha was because the kids were descendants, while with Bruin, it's ancestry. The issue was, I wasn't talking about busha. I was saying that sometimes you could have great forefathers, and we see what happens to the descendants, and we don't think it reflects poorly, or usually we don't think it reflects poorly. These things happen. Especially in 18th century, if you know everyone, all the great heretics were descended from Rabbanim, basically, or well-known religious Jews, because everyone was religious. So, but that's what the Cypher says. iPad says, there are people who believe the Summer Rosh is a forgery, but believe the Zohar was written by Rashbi. Well, yeah, all the Rabbanim who know about the Summer Rosh think it's a forgery, but they also believe Zohar was written by Rashbi. And then the Pani, that's the standard view. The standard rabbinic view is that Besamim Rosh is a forgery. This Rabbi Amar is an outlier publishing this book saying that it's not. And the standard rabbinic view is that the Zohar is written by Rashbi. Absolutely. Mel says, Rav David Katz did a biography of Rishmo of Modena a couple of weeks ago. I've only listened to a few of Rabbi David Katz's talks. I highly encourage everyone not to, not to do it during this time, but he doesn't conflict with us. I don't think it's a problem. I don't consider it competition. We each do our own thing. And I've already mentioned his wonderful dissertation on the Note of Yehuda. So thank you for that, Mel. Many, many people believe that the Zohar was written by Rashbi, even though they didn't know Besamim Rosh is a forgery. The two are totally unrelated. Yes, Mel hit it on the nail on the head. iPad says the idea is to be surprised that a non-Orthodox rabbi person can be concerned and proud of being Jewish, a supporter of the land of Israel, etc., is what I find surprising. Yes, that is true. And Rabbi Kelman cites about the tefillin. Let me just go on through this quickly. Hyman says that Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, in his book on wine, he actually has two volumes on wine, one is called Yenam, traces development of how the Baal Tosfos Heter to get Hanah from Gentile wine, thereby allowing Jewish landowners to actually foreclose on Stam Yenam to collect their debts, if pushed to its logical conclusion, would actually permit drinking Stam Yenam. Obviously, that line of thought was shut down. Yes, and as Chaim Soloveitchik has made the point, and also Yaakov Katz, the Rishonim could have easily, the Baal Tosfos, gotten rid of the issue of Stam Yenam. They did all sorts of other things which were based on less halachic sources. What the term that Chaim, that Professor Katz uses is ritual instinct. There was the idea that you would drink non-Jewish wine was so tied up with the church and idolatry and all these things, even if technically the real issue was, even if you could also cite the issue of intermarriage, but there was such a ritual instinct that they never could be brought to do that, even though they can come up with all sorts of other things. The only, what they did is when they needed, for example, trade for business, that they could find all sorts of riterium, but for wine, and wine was a necessity in medieval times. They didn't drink the water. Do you know how much wine they drank? It was like, that was the main sort, that was the main thing they drank was wine. The amount of wine they drank, Chaim has in his book, he has some of the figures they give. They drank at breakfast, lunch, and dinner because the water was dangerous. And it was a huge, huge imposition and difficulty not to drink this. And yet, because of the ritual instinct that this was connected to idolatry, even though heterim were available, if they wanted to go that direction, they did not go. What I discuss in Changing the Immutable is that a couple hundred years afterwards, this starts to break down. And we know that in Moravia and in Italy, otherwise religious Jews were drinking non-Jewish wine, and none other than Ramosha Isserles justifies it. Now, the way he justifies it is the exact same way it could have been justified by the Baal Tosfos, but they didn't. And the Ramah, he's not saying you should, but he doesn't want to consider these people sinners. Incidentally, I did a podcast. There's a guy, Rabbi Drew Kaplan. He has a whole podcast, probably has 100 episodes now, all on Jewish wine and Jewish drinking. Now, I don't drink. I don't drink wine. I don't drink liquor. But he has a whole thing on that. So we did a whole session on, you can find it on the Ramaz Tshuva. But you can read about it. You can, if you're into kosher wine and liquor, you can listen to him. Rabbi Shunel tells us how he studied with Jacobs. So the iPad says, people are complex. Doesn't Rambam rely on the Rush, and we know how he is highly esteemed. I'm not sure what you mean, because the Rambam doesn't rely on the Rush, that's for sure. And thank you, Hyman. So I was privately pointed out, yes, I was, for some reason, I was thinking in my mind, I was thinking Nivel with a base. So we have lots of examples of this, by the way. I can bring you some examples next week where even Gedol Yisrael, and we even have an example in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Ramah, as I recall, or no, maybe it's the Mishnah Berurah. No, it's the Ramah, I think, where you have something like this. And we have an example in the Gemara where you see that someone was, I think it's the Vilna Shas, and Rav David Cohen mentioned it, I have to find it, where you see that someone was reading and it was copied wrong, that is a Suf instead of Samech or something. So we have examples of this. So, and by the way, if you look in a number of Sfarim, including Ephraim Margolios' book on writing on Sefer Torah, the letter Sadi is always written Tzaddik. You know, that's another example. They're always writing Tzaddik, so sometimes with a kuf at the end. But we have examples over letter where words misspelled because of how they heard them. Mel says he found it very noteworthy that Tsachotchovsky is very critical of the dialogue article. I don't know why you'd find it noteworthy, Mel. I don't see how anyone who knows the sources could not be critical. The article is complete nonsense. What was the context of the Rush's tshuva? Well, the Rush in quotes, he doesn't have the context because he's not responding. He's just, he's created it, of course. The context is, I'll read you the beginning here. Some of them, he just, he has the question, like we saw. In this one, he just, he's responding to someone who wants to know, about what's important, you know, the people they've studied philosophy and there's Torah. How does this work? Basically, he was asked to discuss Jewish theology. And in a way, the real Rush never would have. And Nissen says, Amevin Yavin v'amaskol Yidom. And that's the last thing we'll say. That language is used, Amaskol Yidom by Ibn Ezra. It means the enlightened will be silent. He's not referring to enlightened like 18th century enlightened. He's referring to ones who have the hidden, the secret knowledge. And that what he's saying right there is this verse we spoke about in the past. It says, Haknani Yaz Ba'aretz. I think that's Yud Bey's Vav, Breshis. And Ibn Ezra hints to the fact that this is one of the post-Mosaic verses. He says that this is one way to read it, but if it's not this, Hamaskil Yidom, and the intelligent will be silent, and they won't say it out loud, because this is the sort of thing you're not supposed to speak out loud. If you look at the beginning of Devarim, though, Perek Aleph, I think it's Pusuk Hey, he then gives it away, because he has the list of all them, and he says, he includes Hakanani, Asbaris, and the others. So with that, I thank you all for coming out, and Rabbi Kelman,
thank you very much. I think, by the way, Arch Girl sold 1 million Sidurim. That's what I seem to have heard. That,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
not the
oh,
same thing. I know it's not the same thing.
You're
right.
The Pnina
Halacha, which I pulled it up because I wanted to look up,
I think every English speaking house or Orthodox house, and of course non-Orthodox many as well, but is there an English speaking Orthodox house that does not have an Arch Girl sitter as well as other Arch Girl books? It's an unbelievable achievement what they were able to do. But again, that's not a safer.
I understand. No, I just said, as far as I know, we're still waiting for the first PhD on the art school phenomena, because art school basically changed the face of Orthodoxy. Whatever you want to say about it, but okay, that's whole other decision. I'm not familiar with the dialogue article you're referring to, actually.
No, that's Grossman, Heshy Grossman. He decided he wanted to destroy
from a while back.
Yeah, well done.
Okay, fine. So I am familiar. Okay.
I'm not done with that. I've done three.
I saw.
Four or five more, even though everyone says it's a waste of time. I shouldn't do it. But
yeah, it's a waste of time.
I'm going to acknowledge it. He makes in that article, 50 pages, he does point out one thing, which I think he's right, and I'll acknowledge I made a mistake there, but the rest of it, I If I get to it, so who knows.
Okay. So we look forward to seeing you next week. Tomorrow morning, Aaron Kohler continues with this really fascinating series, I think, on Megillat Esther. Last week, how to read Megillat Esther. He gave a very, quite a very interesting read last week, and we'll continue tomorrow. That's 9:30 a.m., with your coffee. And then at 11 a.m., Rachel Sharansky-Danziger begins her series on the ins and outs of liberty, going through issues in Sefer Shmot, the ins and outs of liberty. She's spoken a couple of series before, and I invite everybody. That's at 11 a.m. We're starting tomorrow morning. And then at 1 p.m., Alex Israel continues his series on Eliyahu Hanavi. So, and then we got all our regular classes during the week, Wednesday, Dr. Kellner, and Mark is Italy. Mark will be in Italy this Wednesday at 2 p.m. as we continue our series on Jewish communities around the world. Hopefully, as we've said, we will be visiting some of these Jewish communities around the world in the next few months, please God. And then Thursday night's Parsha Shir this week will be given by Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner of the Zichron Dov Beit Midrash here in Toronto, and the regular shearing, my shear on the Siddur Friday morning, and Shuli Mishkin and Malka Simkowitz and Dr. Sokolo Wednesday, Thursday. So got lots to keep you busy. Please invite a friend to join us. And yes, Mel, correct. Yeah, he really was quite fascinating. That's the more 9:30, Dr. Kohler. And we look forward to learning with you and your friends, and everybody have a Laila Tov. Good night, and thank you very much. Bye-bye, everybody.